contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the May 15, 1948 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Symbols and Signs, by Vladimir Nabokov. For the fourth time in as many years, they were confronted with the problem of what birthday present to take to a young man who was incurably deranged in his mind. Desires he had none. Man-made objects were to him either hives of evil, vibrant with malignant activity that he alone could perceive, or gross comforts for which no use could be found in his abstract world. After eliminating a number of articles that might offend him or frighten him, anything in the gadget line, for instance, was taboo, his parents chose a dainty and innocent trifle, a basket with 10 different fruit jellies in 10 little jars. At the time of his birth, they had already been married for a long time. A score of years had elapsed, and now they were quite old. Her drab gray hair was pinned up carelessly. She wore cheap black dresses. Unlike other women of her age, such as Mrs. Soule, their next-door neighbor, whose face was all pink and mauve with paint, and whose hat was a cluster of Brookside flowers, she presented a naked, white countenance to the fault-finding light of spring. Her husband, who in the old country had been a fairly successful businessman, was now, in New York, wholly dependent on his brother Isaac, a real American of almost 40 years' standing. They seldom saw Isaac, and had nicknamed him the Prince. That Friday, their son's birthday, everything went wrong. The subway train lost its life current between two stations, and for a quarter of an hour they could hear nothing but the dutiful beating of their hearts and the rustling of newspapers. The bus they had to take next was late and kept them waiting a long time on a street corner, and when it did come, it was crammed with garrulous high school children. It began to rain as they walked up the brown path leading to the sanitarium. There they waited again, and instead of their boy shuffling into the room, as he usually did, his poor face sullen, confused, ill-shaven, and blotched with acne, a nurse they knew and did not care for appeared at last and brightly explained that he had again attempted to take his life. He was all right, she said, but a visit from his parents might disturb him. The place was so miserably understaffed, and things got mislaid or mixed up so easily, that they decided not to leave their present in the office, but to bring it to him next time they came. Outside the building, she waited for her husband to open his umbrella and then took his arm. He kept clearing his throat, as he always did when he was upset. They reached the bus stop shelter on the other side of the street, and he closed his umbrella. A few feet away, under a swaying and dripping tree, a tiny unfledged bird was helplessly twitching in a puddle. During the long ride to the subway station, she and her husband did not exchange a word, and every time she glanced at his old hands clasped and twitching upon the handle of his umbrella, and saw their swollen veins and brown-spotted skin, she felt the mounting pressure of tears. As she looked around, trying to hook her mind onto something, it gave her a kind of a soft shock, a mixture of compassion and wonder, to notice that one of the passengers, a girl with dark hair and grubby red toenails, was weeping on the shoulder of an older woman. Whom did that woman resemble? She resembled Rebecca Borisnova, whose daughter had married one of the Solofezchiks in Minsk years ago. The last time the boy had tried to do it, his method had been, in the doctor's words, a masterpiece of inventiveness. He would have succeeded had not an envious fellow patient thought he was learning to fly and stopped him just in time. What he had really wanted to do was to tear a hole in his world and escape. The system of his delusions had been the subject of an elaborate paper in a scientific monthly, which the doctor at the sanitarium had given it to them to read. But long before that, she and her husband had puzzled it out for themselves. Referential mania, the article had called it. In these very rare cases, the patient imagines that everything happening around him is a veiled reference to his personality and existence. He excludes real people from the conspiracy because he considers himself to be so much more intelligent than other men. Phenomenal nature shadows him wherever he goes. Clouds in the staring sky transmit to each other by means of slow signs incredibly detailed information regarding him. His inmost thoughts are discussed at nightfall in manual alphabet by darkling, gesticulating trees. Pebbles or stains or sunflecks form patterns representing, in some awful way, messages that he must intercept. Everything is a cipher, and of everything he is at the theme. He is the theme. All around him there are spies. Some of them are detached observers, like glass surfaces and still pools. Others, such as coats and store windows, are prejudiced witnesses, lynchers at heart. Others, again, running water, storms, are hysterical to the point of insanity, have a distorted opinion of him and grotesquely misinterpret his actions. He must be always on his guard and devote every minute and module of life to the decoding of the undulation of things. The very air he exhales is indexed and filed away. If only the interest he provokes were limited to his immediate surroundings, but alas, it is not. With distance, the torrents of wild scandal increase in volume and volubility. The silhouettes of his blood corpuscles, magnified a million times, flit over vast plains. And still further away, great mountains of unbearable solidity and height sum up, in terms of granite and groaning firs, the ultimate truth of his being. When the emerged from the thunder and foul air of the subway, the last dregs of the day were mixed with the street lights. She wanted to buy some fish for supper, so she handed him the basket of jelly jars, telling him to go home. Accordingly, he returned to their tenement house, walked up to the third landing, and then remembered he had given her his keys earlier in the day. In silence, he sat down on the steps, and in silence rose when, some 10 minutes later, she came trudging heavily up the stairs, smiling wanly and shaking her head in deprecation of her silliness. They entered their two-room flat, and he at once went to the mirror. Straining the corners of his mouth apart by means of his thumbs, with a horrible mask-like grimace, he removed his new, hopelessly uncomfortable dental plate. He read his Russian-language newspaper while she laid the table. Still reading, he ate the pale victuals that needed no teeth. She knew his moods and also was silent. When he had gone to bed, she remained in the living room with her pack of soiled playing cards and her old photograph albums. Across the narrow courtyard, where the rain tinkled in the dark against some ash cans, windows were blandly alight, and in one of them, a black-trousered man, with hands clasped under his head and his elbows raised, could he be seen lying supine on an untidy bed. She pulled the blind down and examined the photographs. As a baby, he looked more surprised than most babies. A photograph of a German maid they had in Leipzig, and her fat-faced fiancé fell out of a fold of the album. She turned the pages of the book, Minsk, the Revolution, Leipzig, Berlin, Leipzig again, a slanting house front, badly out of focus. Here was the boy when he was 4 years old, in a park, shyly, with puckered forehead, looking away from an eager squirrel, as he would have from any other stranger. Here was Aunt Rosa, a fussy, angular, wild-eyed old lady, who had lived in a tremulous world of bad news, bankruptcies, train accidents, and cancerous growths, until the Germans put her to death, together with all the other people she had worried about. The boy, age 6, that was when he drew wonderful birds with human hands and feet and suffered from insomnia like a grown-up man. His cousin, now a famous chess player, the boy, again, aged about 8, already had to understand, afraid of the wallpaper in the passage, afraid of a certain picture in a book, which merely showed an idyllic landscape with rocks and a hillside and an old cartwheel hanging from the one branch of a leafless tree. Here he was at 10, the year they left Europe. She remembered the shame, the pity, the humiliating difficulties of the journey, and the ugly, vicious, backward children he was with in the special school where he had been placed after they arrived in America. And then came a time in his life, coinciding with a long convalescence after pneumonia, when those little phobias of his, which his parents had stubbornly regarded as the eccentricities of a prodigiously gifted child, hardened, as it were, into a dense tangle of logically interacting illusions, making them totally inaccessible to normal minds. All this, and much more, she had accepted, for, after all, living does mean accepting the loss of one joy after another. Not even joys in her case, mere possibilities of improvement. She thought of the recurrent waves of pain that, for some reason or other, she and her husband had had to endure. Of the invisible giants hurting her boy in some unimaginable fashion. Of the incalculable amount of tenderness contained in the world. Of the fate of this tenderness, which is either crushed or wasted or transformed into madness. Of neglected children humming to themselves in unwept corners. Of beautiful weeds that cannot hide from the farmer. It was nearly midnight when, from the living room, she heard her husband moan, and presently he staggered in, wearing over his nightgown the old overcoat with a Strachan collar that he much preferred to his nice blue bathrobe. "I can't sleep," he cried. "Well, why can't you sleep?" she asked. "You were so tired." "I can't sleep because I am dying," he said and lay down on the couch. "Is it your stomach? You want me to call Dr. Solov?" "No, doctors. No, doctors," he moaned. "To the devil with doctors. We must get him out of there quick. Otherwise, we'll be responsible. Responsible." And he hurled himself into a sitting position, both feet on the floor, thumping his forehead with his clenched fist. "All right," she said quietly. "We'll bring him home tomorrow. Tomorrow morning." "I would like some tea," said her husband and went out to the bathroom. Bending with difficulty, she retrieved some playing cards and a photograph or two that had slipped to the floor. The Knave of Hearts, the Nine of Spades, the Ace of Spades, the Maid Elsa and her bestial beau. He returned in high spirits, saying in a loud voice, "I have it all figured out. We will give him the bedroom. Each of us will spend part of the night near him and the other part on the couch. We will have the doctor see him at least twice a week. It does not matter what the prince says. He won't have much to say anyway because it will come out cheaper." The telephone rang. It was an unusual hour for it to ring. He stood in the middle of the room, groping with his foot for one slipper that had come off, and childishly, toothlessly gaped at his wife. Since she knew more English than he, she always attended to the calls. "Can I speak to Charlie?" a girl's dull little voice said to her now. "Well, what number do you want?" "No, you have the wrong number." She put the receiver down gently and her hand went to her heart. "It frightened me," she said. He smiled a quick smile and immediately resumed his excited monologue. They would fetch him as soon as it was day. For his own protection, they would keep all the knives in a locked drawer. Even at his worst, he presented no danger to other people. The telephone rang a second time. The same toneless, anxious young voice asked for Charlie. "Well, you have the incorrect number. I will tell you what you are doing. You are turning the letter 0 instead of 0. Excuse me. You are turning the letter O instead of the 0. She hung up again. They sat down to their unexpected festive midnight tea. He sipped noisily. His face was flushed. Every now and then he raised his glass with a circular motion so as to make the sugar dissolve more thoroughly. The vein on the side of his bald head stood out conspicuously, and silvery bristles showed on his chin. The birthday present stood on the table. While she poured him another glass of tea, he put on his spectacles and re-examined with pleasure the luminous yellow, green, and red little jars. His clumsy, moist lips spelled out their eloquent labels. Apricot, grape, beech plum, quince. He had got to crab apple when the telephone rang again. And now, from the Department of Kindness section of the January 20th, 2014 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Breadline. Crushed plastic top hats, ribbons, tassels, and other festive detritus littered the streets as several dozen people lined up on the sidewalk in front of the Church of St. Francis of Assisi. By Ian Fraser. On the first morning of the new year, a few dozen people stood in a line on the sidewalk in front of the Church of St. Francis of Assisi at 135 West 31st Street. The sky was still dark. Nearby, in an entry to Penn Station, leftover New Year's Eve partiers lay here and there. Crushed plastic top hats, shish kebab skewers, ribbons, tassels, and other festive detritus littered the streets. One man, waiting in the line, wore outsized spectacles that spelled out 2014 in green lights. But he was otherwise as subdued as those around him. They were the early arrivals to the church's daily bread line, which gives out food, coffee, and sometimes clothes or other necessities every morning at 7 o'clock. The bread line has existed since September 1930 and is the oldest continuously operating bread line in the United States. An apartment building behind the church rose six times as high as the steeple. In the firehouse across the street, fire engines still had big Christmas wreaths above their front bumpers. The line quickly grew longer, stretching past a row of 40 bright blue city bikes along the curb. Dawn came up 31st Street one way, while a cold wind went the other. In photographs taken during the Depression, almost everybody in breadlines is wearing cloth caps or fedoras. But in this line, the common headgear was hoods. People hunched under them and smoked or talked quietly. A gaunt-looking woman, a regular of the Penn Station waiting rooms, was smiling, an unfamiliar expression, and wishing her neighbors a happy New Year through skeleton teeth. Church workers arrived with boxes of gloves to give away, and people crowded around. Once they had their gloves, they went back to their former place in the line. Volunteers wheeled a cart of food from the side entrance of the church. With them was Father Paul Lestrito, the program's executive director, a 57-year-old Franciscan friar who lives in the church's monastery. He wore glasses, a baseball cap, and a hooded brown habit cinched at the waist by a white rope with three knots at one end, representing the Franciscan vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Some friars prefer leather sandals, but Father Paul's were orange Crocs. At seven exactly, the church's first set of bells began to chime, followed soon by its second set, which filled the canyon of 31st Street with a pleasing antiphony. Moving down the line, Father Paul and other staff members handed out about 450 white plastic bags containing a turkey sandwich on a Kaiser roll, crackers, cake, and a carton of juice. The bags had the I Heart New York logo on them and were biodegradable. St. Francis is considered to have been the most environmentally conscious of the saints. As the line continued past the coffee urns, it was met by Sikhs who were giving out bags of fresh fruit. The Sikhs, from Long Island, had read about Pope Francis in the news, admired him, and looked up information about the saint whose name he had taken. "We like very much what we learn about St. Francis," Baldev Srichawla, one of the Sikhs, told the bystander. He was not a lavish person. He lived humbly and cared for the poor, and we Sikhs believe in helping the needy. When we found out about this church named after him, we wished to participate in this food line, too. Afterward, in a small meeting room in the church offices, Father Paul said that he began training for the order in 1989 and was ordained in 1996. In 2001, he left, worked in a homeless shelter in Harlem, and then became the director of a hospice organization. In 2006, he almost died from pulmonary embolism. When he recovered, he decided to return to the order. By then, he owned a co-op apartment in Washington Heights, a car, and many works of art. As the order requires, he gave almost everything away. Now he has only a few possessions and spends more than half of his $500 a month allowance on food and medicine for his 12-year-old cat, Clement. Not many people have any idea how poor a lot of the folks around here are, he said. Elderly folks especially, in the public housing apartment buildings on the west side in the 20s. There are people worse off than some who are in the breadline, but they can't get out. That's why we've started a program to take groceries to them. Right now we're serving over 100 families with bags of groceries a week. And how about starting a laundromat with a community center maybe, and nurses to help people with medical problems? There are almost no inexpensive places for people to do their wash in Manhattan anymore. Starting a laundromat is my dream. Next, from the January 4th and 11th, 2021 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the book section, Personal Jesus, What Thomas Jefferson Did to the Gospels, by Vincent Cunningham. In the early months of 1803, perhaps the most consequential period of Thomas Jefferson's presidency, if not for him the busiest, American envoys were in France, Jefferson's old ambassadorial stomping ground, negotiating the terms of what would later be called the Louisiana Purchase. Jefferson, meanwhile, was mulling a book project. He imagined it as a work of comparative moral philosophy, which would include a survey of, quote, the most remarkable of the ancient philosophers, then swiftly address the repulsive ethics of the Jews, before demonstrating that the system of morality offered by Jesus was the most benevolent and sublime, probably, that has ever been taught, end quote. This sublimity, however, would need to be rescued from the Gospels, which were, as Jefferson put it in a letter to the English chemist, philosopher, and minister Joseph Priestley, written by, quote, the most unlettered of men by memory long after they had heard them from him, end quote. Jefferson pushed Priestley to write the treatise, and by the following January seemed to think that he would. But Priestley died in February, and Jefferson decided to do the salvage work, at least. He got a copy of the Bible, cut out some choice passages, glued them onto blank pages, and called the volume The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted from the account of his life and doctrines as given by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Being an abridgment of the New Testament for the use of Indians unembarrassed with matters of fact or faith beyond the level of their comprehensions. One of Jefferson's aims seems to have been to demonstrate to himself, if to no one else, that, contrary to the claims of his political adversaries, he was not anti-Christian. As Peter Monceau, a curator at the National Museum of American History, points out in The Jefferson Bible, a biography, published by Princeton, the puzzling reference to Indians in the subtitle may be a joke about the Federalists and their apparent inability to grasp Jefferson's true beliefs. His opponents often labeled him a free thinker or an outright atheist. Milder observers came closer to the mark, pegging him as a deist who largely thought of God as a non-interventionist. But Jefferson did not openly claim the deist label. I am a Christian, he insisted in a letter to the educator and politician Benjamin Rush. In the only sense in which he wished anyone to be sincerely attached to his doctrines, in preference to all others, ascribing to himself every human excellence, and believing he never claimed any other. In order to establish that this was the actual limit of Jesus' claims, one had to carefully extricate him from the texts that contain nearly all we know about his life and thought. That might sound like impossible surgery, but to Jefferson, the fissures were obvious. What was genuinely Christ was, quote, as easily distinguishable as diamonds in a dunghill, end quote, he wrote in a letter to John Adams. Jesus in the Gospel of John says, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. Jefferson was no lamb and no follower, but he considered himself a good hearer. Manceau opens his study with an anecdote from earlier in Jefferson's life, which Jefferson recounts in Notes on the State of Virginia. As a young man, he went digging through one of the barrows, huge mounds of earth covered in grass that mysteriously dotted the Virginia landscape. That they were repositories of the dead has been obvious to all, but on what particular occasion constructed was matter of doubt, Jefferson wrote. The solution for Jefferson was to get a shovel. He traveled to what had been once a Native American community and got to work on a mound, quickly finding collections of human bones. There were arms and bones and loose jaws, vertebrae and several skulls. Manceau writes this. It was the skulls that most drew Jefferson's interest. Some were so tender, he noted, that they fell apart at the touch, leaving him with a handful of teeth that were considerably smaller than others. At least one section of the mound seemed to include children, a suspicion reinforced by the discoveries that followed, a rib and a fragment of the under jaw of a person about half grown, another rib of an infant, and part of the jaw of a child which had not yet cut its teeth. Manceau adds, quote, today the image of Jefferson rummaging through the bones of Native Americans would likely be regarded by many as an obvious desecration, while in his own day it would have been praised as purely scientific inquiry, end quote. Manceau uses this unsettling anecdote to illustrate the desacralizing impulse in Jefferson, the impulse that would lead to his cut-and-paste Bible. Jefferson had seen Monacans go in groups to visit the mounds, but the knowledge of their reverence and the ardency of their devotion didn't satisfy him. He was deeply impatient with myth, ritual, and mystery. He had to see the bones. Even in his youth, Jefferson had bridled at the core metaphysical claims of classical Christianity. Jefferson had no use for original sin, or salvation by grace alone, or the insistence that Christ, or anyone else, stand down. Lazarus had risen from the dead. He didn't even care to affirm the most fundamental doctrine that, by some mystery of history and providence, Jesus was of the same essence as God, indeed was God. One of Jefferson's first and most lasting points of dissent with Christian orthodoxy had to do with the Trinity, the doctrine affirming that although there is only one God, the Godhead is identified as three distinct but inseparable persons. The Father, who is the Creator, the Son, who appeared on earth in order to reconcile humanity to the Father, and the Holy Spirit, who is the breath of love between Father and Son, and who invisibly knits all believers together, creating the society called the Church. To Jefferson, this was all too fuzzy to be true in any real sense, an incomprehensible jargon. Jefferson was a follower of Jesus in more or less the way that Plato was a follower of Socrates. He found his morals high, his wisdom excellent, his philosophy sound, his observations true. This is a vision of Jesus as a great man, a mover of history, and a moral tinkerer whose work had been marred by the friends who were his lessers. Jefferson tended, in his letters, to portray Jesus as a modernizer, more clarifier than Christ. He called him a great reformer of the vicious ethic and deism of the Jews, a formulation that marries anti-Semitic tropes with a rereading of Christianity's roots through the logic of the Reformation. For Jefferson, Jesus was to Judaism what Luther was to the Catholic Church. And Jefferson, in turn, after digging through Christianity's burial heap, would rescue those of its tenets which accorded with reason, his reason, from the vicious ethic that had grown up around it. In the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson insisted that all people were created equal, but he also made sure to invoke the laws of nature and nature's God, a favorite phrase of the deists of his day. The urge to independence hadn't come down from a mountain etched on tablets, but was instead the logical endpoint of a long process of looking and of thought. God was sovereign only so far as you could track his moves, like an animal leaving footprints in snow. The philosophy of Jesus did not survive. The only evidence we have for it is in Jefferson's correspondence. But in the 1810s, after he had left the White House and had withdrawn almost totally from public life, Jefferson began working on what was essentially a new edition, incorporating not only the English of the King James Version, but also columns of translation. This version bears a slightly shorter title, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English. He had tried once again, as he put in a letter to a young acolyte, to separate the gold from the dross. Jefferson's Jesus is born in a manger, but there are no angels and no wise men. At age 12, he speaks to the doctors in the temple, and everyone is impressed. But he doesn't say that he is about my father's business. When Jefferson's Jesus suddenly has disciples, it is not clear why they have decided to follow him. Jefferson includes Jesus's encounter with a man with a withered hand and his argument about whether it is lawful to heal on the Sabbath days. The gold in this story, apparently, is the idea that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The dross is the part where Jesus turns to address the poor man directly, like a real person instead of a prop for a conjectural argument, and heals his hand. Even at this late date, some who knew Jefferson believed that publishing such a text would tarnish his name. The Virginia minister Charles Clay, upon hearing about the idea, warned him that it may affect your future character and reputation on the page of history as a patriot, legislator, and sound philosopher. Jefferson finished The Life and Morals in 1820, and according to acquaintances, he read from it often before going to sleep. But when he died, 6 years later, only a few of his friends were aware that it existed. Nearly a century passed before the wee little book, as Jefferson once called it, came fully into public view. The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth was brought to public attention in 1895 by Cyrus Adler, an observant Jew from Arkansas, who was a librarian and a curator of religious items at the Smithsonian. Nearly a decade earlier, as a doctoral student searching the private library of a wealthy family, Adler had happened upon a set of Bibles that Jefferson had owned, with key passages of the Gospel snipped from their pages. Now, charged with mounting an exhibition on American religion and still mulling over that discovery, Adler finally figured out where the missing passages had gone, into Jefferson's little book, which was hidden away in the library of Carolina Ramsey Randolph, Jefferson's great-granddaughter. Adler bought the book from Randolph for $400 and promptly put it on display in the Capitol, where, in Jefferson's time, it would almost certainly have been a scandal. Now it was met mostly with affectionate enthusiasm as another example of Jefferson's wide-ranging brilliance. In 1904, the government printing offices made the first official set of reproductions, one of which was to be given to each U.S. congressperson. By the 1920s, there were 5 editions in circulation, both as cheap pocket-sized books and as collector items, Monceau wrote. Notes. America's national ambitions were going global. After the Spanish-American War, the country had seized possession of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. If Jefferson needed a Jesus who could fit the imperatives of republicanism and Western expansion, Teddy Roosevelt, later to become Jefferson's neighbor on Mount Rushmore, needed to christen a budding empire. The new attitude was evident even in the nation's architecture. The National Mall, for which Jefferson in 1791 had sketched a plan of public walks, was reimagined as a site of Romanesque splendor. Eventually, the Jefferson Memorial was laid on the bank of the tidal basin, just across from the mall, and among the documents placed under the cornerstone were the Declaration and the Life and Morals. There's a photograph of that monument taken by Henri Cartier-Bresson in 1957 during the heat of the black struggle for civil rights. Two black boys, facing in opposite directions, dawdle just across the tidal basin from the memorial. A gentle row of trees and the dome dedicated to Jefferson loom just above their heads. The photograph is a reminder that, science and reason notwithstanding, Jefferson's laconic Jesus, full of wisdom and bereft of spiritual power, never persuaded him to forfeit the slaves he owned. The boys in the photograph could be Jefferson's kids. As Americans, they sort of were. Since 2011, a monument to Martin Luther King, Jr. has sat across the water from the Jefferson Memorial, almost engaging it in a staring contest. The result is a rich spatial symbolism, two ways of seeing Christ duking it out. King saw Jesus in much the way that Frederick Douglass did, as a savior, a redeemer, and a liberator, sorely degraded by those who claimed his name most loudly. During the Montgomery bus boycott, King reportedly carried a copy of Jesus and the Disinherited, a short, beautiful book by the minister and writer Howard Thurman. Thurman had traveled to India, where he had made sure to meet Gandhi, whose doctrine of nonviolence he had admired. He took what he learned from Gandhi back to America, planting an important intellectual seed that would blossom during the civil rights movement. In his preachings and writings, Thurman reoriented what he called the religion of Jesus, pointing out what it might mean for those who had lived for so long under the thumb of the likes of Jefferson. Jefferson's Jesus is an admirable sage, fit bedtime reading for seekers of wisdom. But those who were weak or suffering or in urgent trouble would have to look elsewhere. The masses of men live with their backs constantly against the wall, Thurman wrote. What does our religion say to them? Thurman's Jesus was a genius of love, a love so complete and intimate that it suggested a nearby God who had grown up in a forgotten town and was now renting the rundown house across the street. That same humble deity, in the course of putting on humanity, had obtained the glimpse of the conditions on earth. Poverty, needless estrangement, a stubborn pattern of rich ruling over poor, and decided to incite a revolution that would harrow hell. The basic fact is that Christianity, as it was born in the mind of the Jewish teacher and thinker, appears as a technique of survival for the oppressed, Thurman wrote. This is a Jesus that Jefferson could never understand. In a world as compromised as ours, a soul so exalted was always destined for the cross. Jefferson's Bible ends before the resurrection, with Jesus crucified by the Roman occupiers, as the Gospels tell us he was. Jefferson's austere editing turns the killing almost into an afterthought, a desiccated reiteration of Socrates' final encounter with Hemlock, the simple consequence of having offended the wrong people. For Thurman, the crucifixion was an emphatic lesson in creative weakness. By sticking out his neck and accepting the full implications of his own vulnerability, Christ had radically identified himself with the worst off. Those societal cast-offs who could never get a break now had a savior and a champion and a model. This, for Thurman, is as great a teaching as anything that Jesus merely said. Where death for Jefferson's Jesus is an ending, for Thurman's, it is a necessary precondition, just a start. And now, from the Culture Desk of the December 28, 2015 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Auld Lang Syne and Four Generations of My Family by Allison Hobbs. Every year, as the hour grows late on Christmas night, my father's eyes become misty. He sits at the dining table after our holiday feast and stares off in the direction of the CD player, holding the remote in his hand. He wears a light blue cashmere V-neck sweater over a neat button-down shirt and brown corduroy pants, classic gifts for Dad from previous Christmas times. The 1963 album Christmas with the Platters plays, and a dreamy version of Auld Lang Syne wafts through the living room. My father slowly takes off his glasses and dabs his eyes. The phrase Auld Lang Syne translates to times gone by. And while Americans expect to hear this song every New Year's, few know of what the Scottish lyrics actually mean. So most New Year's Eve revelers just mumble or hum along. But they get the gist of the main question of the song. Should old friends be forgotten? And the answer, of course, is no. The past must be remembered. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne? While the song absorbs my father, plates are cleared, dishes are washed, Uno cards are located, and new rules for the game are debated. The after-dinner hustle and bustle do not disturb my father's reverie. For those few minutes that Auld Lang Syne plays, he is far away from the dining table in Morristown, New Jersey, where he had celebrated Christmas for the past 35 years. He's a little boy, 7 or 8 years old, in a small apartment on the south side of Chicago, which he shares with his sister, his mother, and his grandmother. It's in the early 1950s, and he sits by the radio with his family, looking at the frosted Christmas tree with bubbly lights. He is dressed in his finest clothes. There was a time when families got dressed up for the holidays. Remember that, Joyce? He asked my mother. He laughs as he describes the suit that he wore, with a skinny tie, when they were first married, my mother's fancy dresses, and the special holiday outfits purchased for my older sisters and brother. For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet, for Auld Lang Syne. And surely you'll buy your pint cup, and surely I'll buy mine, and we'll take a cup of kindness yet, for Auld Lang Syne. Robert Burns, the Scottish poet, wrote Auld Lang Syne in 1788. His life was not an easy one. Perhaps his suffering and hardships imbued his poetry with its signature passion and intensity. When his father died, his farm was on the brink of failure, and Burns and his brothers moved the family to a new farm in an effort to stay afloat. The labor that the farm required seemed to leave Burns with a heart condition that afflicted him later in life. Known as the peasant poet, Burns fathered at least a dozen children with several women, and after leaving the farm, he spent most of his career compiling traditional Scottish folk songs that celebrate life, love, work, drinking, and friendship, using warm melodies and emotional chords. Auld Lang Syne was not intended to be a holiday standard, but in 1929, the legendary bandleader Guy Lombardo, known as Mr. New Year, used it to connect two radio programs during a live performance at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York. Lombardo's band played Auld Lang Syne just as the clock struck midnight. A tradition was born. Lombardo brought in the New Year with the song for almost 50 years, from the stock market crash in 1929 to his last performance during the country's bicentennial in 1976. Lombardo died in 1977. We too have run about the slopes and picked the daisies fine, but we've wandered many a weary foot since Auld Lang Syne. As the youngest of two children and the only boy in his family, my father was doted on, adored, and treasured. His family did not have much money, but, as he would later tell us with a smile, we didn't know we were poor. His grandmother cleaned the homes of white families and often came back to the apartment with stories of what the white folks do. Setting the Christmas table with her best china, she would turn to my father and my aunt and say with satisfaction, "This is the way the white folks do it." The world of the white folks was just as remote geographically as it was in the imagination and in experience. It was protected by a boundary that no black person, aside from domestics and other workers, dared to cross. My father's grandmother had served the white folks at dinner parties, so she took great pride in making her own celebrations equally special. She wanted her grandchildren to know that, even though they might live in a kitchenette in Chicago's overcrowded black belt, they were just as precious and just as cherished as the white children who lived in the prestigious neighborhoods of the North Shore. We too have paddled in the stream from morning sun till dine, but seas between us broad have roared since Auld Lang Syne. My father's mother worked as a hairdresser. She was a master of improvisation, the original mother of invention. While she worked, she sent my father and my aunt to double features at movie theaters as a less expensive alternative to hiring a babysitter. One year, my grandmother splurged and bought my father a University of Chicago jacket for Christmas. My father, who dreamed of attending the University of Chicago, took great pride in wearing the jacket. Perhaps it was more beloved by him because he knew the sacrifices that his mother had made to buy it. An older boy would steal the jacket before its leather sleeves had the chance to crease. But such was the life for my father, growing up in Chicago back then. And there's a hand, my trusty friend, and give us a hand of thine, and we'll take a right good will draught for Auld Lang Syne. I notice my father as he muses silently about times gone by, and wish that I, too, could go to that kitchenette that he has described so vividly, and glimpse him as a little boy dressed up in his Christmas finery. I wish I could hear the sounds of the crackling radio and join him, my aunt, my grandmother, and my great-grandmother around the dining table or next to the frosted Christmas tree. I drift into my own misty reveries, a childhood when the excitement of Christmas would not let me sleep. Years later, watching my brother-in-law assemble elaborate and exquisite floral centerpieces as his generous gift to us, the games played, the joy and laughter before my sister's illness and untimely death at 31, even the hectic but happy balancing act of celebrating two Christmases, one with my family and one with my husband's family, before our marriage collapsed 4 years ago. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and Auld Lang Syne? My father can't go back to the Chicago of the 1950s. Try as I might, I can't relive my childhood or young adulthood in Morristown. But we can follow the poignant instructions offered in Auld Lang Syne to remember the past, the stories, the scenes, the settings, the friendships, and the family. Perhaps knowing that these memories live on in all of us makes the times gone by a little easier to bear. Finally, from the December 31st, 2007 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the fiction section, a short story entitled The Arbus Factor by Laura Siegel. On one of the first days of the new year, Jack called Hope. "Let's have lunch," he said. "I've got an agenda." No need to specify the Café Provence on Upper Broadway or the time, 15 minutes before noon, when they were sure of getting their table by the window. They did the menu, heard the specials. Hope said, "I'm always going to order something different," but ordered the onion soup. Jack ordered the cassoulet, saying, "I should have the fish." "And a bottle of your Merlot," he told the unsmiling proprietress, "which we will have right away." "We'll share a salad," Hope said. She saw Jack watch the proprietress walk off in the direction of the bar in a remarkably short skirt for a woman of 50. Hope saw the long, brown, athletic legs, bare even in January, with Jack's eyes. Jack, a large man with a heavy, dark face, turned to Hope. "So?" "Okay, I guess you," Jack said. "My agenda, if we were still making resolutions, what would yours be?" Hope's interest pricked right up. "I'm thinking you go first." Jack said, "I'm going to watch what I eat. It's not the weight, It's the constantly thinking of eating. I don't eat real meals unless Jeremy comes over. Jeremy was Jack's son. Hope said, I'm going to watch what I watch, and then I'm going to turn off the TV. It's ugly waking mornings with the thing flickering. It feels debauched. Jack said, I'm not going to order books from Amazon until I've read the ones on my shelves. Hope said, I'm going to hang up my clothes even when nobody is coming over. Nora is very severe with me. Nora was Hope's daughter. The wine arrived. Jack did the label checking, cork sniffing, tasting, and nodding. The salad came. Hope served her their two plates. Jack indicated Hope's hair, which she had done in an upswing. Very fetching, he commented. Well, thank you. Here's an old new resolution. Going to learn French. What was the name of my teacher when we got back from Paris? I once counted 11 years of school French, but it was always you who had to do the talking. Jack said, I want to learn how to pray. Hope looked across the table to see if he was being cute. Jack was concentrating on folding a whole lettuce leaf into his mouth. Hope said, I'll never understand the principle of not cutting it into bite-sized pieces. The onion soup came. The cassoulet came. Jack asked Hope if she would like to go back. Go back? Back to Paris? Jack and Hope had lived together before marrying two other people. Jack subsequently divorced his wife, who had subsequently died. Hope was widowed. To Paris! Die! Jack said. Something I've been meaning to ask you, Hope said. Were you and I ever together in an old, old garden? Did we walk under century-old trees? Did we lie down in the grass and look into tree crowns in France? Or was that in England? Was it an old English garden? Or is this a garden in a book? What's to keep us? Jack said. Well, there were a lot of reasons, of course, to keep them from going back. Two of the littlest were at this moment flattening their noses against the outside of the restaurant window. 10-year-old Benjamin stuck his thumbs in his ears and wiggled his fingers at his grandfather. Hope made as if to catch her granddaughter's hand through the glass. This made little Miranda laugh. And there was Hope's daughter Nora with baby Julie in a stroller, and Jack's son Jeremy standing out on the sidewalk. I'm just going to the bathroom, Hope mouthed to her daughter. What? Nora mouthed back, her face sharpened with irritation. The baby was crying. She knows I can't hear her through the glass, Nora said to Jeremy. Jeremy said, You stay with the kids. I'll go in and get him. I'll see what your mother wants. Jeremy walked into the restaurant, passing Jack and Hope on his way to the corner where, an hour ago, he had folded up his father's wheelchair. Hope stood and came around the table to kiss Jack and be kissed goodbye. On the double, Dad, Jeremy said. I need to get back to the office. I'll call you, Jack said to Hope. We'll have lunch. Hope was mouthing through the window again, and Nora said, Julie, shut up, please. Mom, what? The baby had started screeching. Hope pointed in the direction of the ladies' room. Nora signaled, You need me to go with you? Hope shook her head no. One of the reasons for the Café Provence was that its bathrooms were on the street floor, not in the basement down a long stair. Gathering her coat and bag, Hope opened the door to the ladies' room and saw, in the mirror above the basins, that her hair was coming out of its pins. She removed all the pins and stood gazing at the crone with the gray shoulder-length hair girlishly loosened. Hope saw what Diane Arbus might have seen and was appalled. And being appalled pricked her interest right up. I've got an agenda, the Arbus factor of old age. Hope looked forward to saying to Jack the next time it would be convenient for Jeremy and Nora to arrange lunch for them at the Café Provence. And now from the January 4th and 11th issue of the 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, a poem. Final Poem for My Father, Misnamed in My Mouth, by Philip B. Williams. Sunlight still holds you, and gives your shapelessness to every room. By noon, the kitchen catches your hands, misshapen sun rays. The windows have your eyes, taken from me your body. I reorder my life with absence. You are everywhere now, where once I could not find you even in your own body. Death means everything has become possible. I've been told I have your ways. Your laughter haunts my mother from my mouth. Everything is possible. Father light washes over the kitchen floor. I try to hold a bit of kindness for the dead and make of memory a sponge to wash your corpse. Your name is not addict or sir. This is not a dream. You died and were buried three times, once after my birth, again against your hellos, shedding into closing doors, your face a mask I placed over my face. The final time, you beneath my feet. Was I buried with you then? I will not call what you had left anything other than gone and sweet, perhaps. I am not your junior, but I survived. I fell in love with being your son. Now what? Possibility was a bird I once knew. It had one wing. Well, we have time for a cartoon or two. The first cartoon, a cat and a dog are sitting in a room looking at a goldfish bowl on top of a bookshelf. And the cat says to the dog, "Look, I know you and I have had our differences, but can we at least agree that the goldfish is pointless?" In the next cartoon, a man, middle-aged man, is sitting in front of the desk at a doctor's office. The doctor has a chart out, and the doctor says, I see you're 60. I'd like to get that number down. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed listening to it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you all so much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.